All right, it is January 2015, and we're recording the Chonu Living podcast. My name is Charlie, and I'm joined by Eli and Dan, two relatively long-term Chonu expats. And we have three different topics which we're going to be talking about today. First of which is the pollution in Chengdu, which has been a major topic of discussion among the expat community and among the Chinese resident community as well. The other two topics are Uber being banned in China, which is a major issue, and the third of which is related to a Reddit post that Dan created recently, which asks the question, is life in China real? So let's start with pollution. This is something that relates to everybody in China right now, I think. How has the pollution affected you guys? Why don't you guys start it off?
You said I'm a sort of a long-term Chengduer. I haven't lived here for too much longer than a year. And the 1 year I did live in here in the past, I didn't really react to the pollution a lot. I noticed it, but I didn't do anything. Now that I'm here and I plan to stay here longer, I've invested in some one-time use, or according to my Chinese friend, their one-time use face masks, 3M brand face masks. I don't know, it's hard to tell if they do much for me. But now that I'm going to be here for a longer term, I'm trying to find out how to offset the effect the pollution has on my life.
Yeah, right. So first of all, I think, you know, for anybody who visits Chengdu or lives in Chengdu, I think the issue of pollution is kind of an unavoidable one, because as soon as you head outside, you can smell it, you can see it. I mean, it's pretty much not an issue that you can ignore. And it's exacerbated this time of year.
Yeah, there's no question that there's seasonal factors involved. You know, right now we're here in mid-January. What's today's date?
Is it 16th?
Yeah.
18th, actually, yeah.
18th.
We're way off.
So we're looking at about a month away from the Chinese New Year. And obviously that's a time when a lot of the factories shut down. Mm-hmm. And people go back to their hometowns and there's work stoppages. And my guess would be one of the reasons why the pollution at this time of year is particularly intense is because factories are working overtime to try to make up for the productivity gap that there's going to be in the near future when everybody stops for Spring Festival.
Yeah, we saw that, I mean, right before the national holiday in October, bad smog followed by a couple days of blue sky, probably for the reasons you just mentioned.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting, although the pollution is such an overwhelmingly obvious problem, there's actually very little information on where the pollution comes from and kind of what's being done about it. And so there's a lot of gossip and conjecture about these things. So there's a lot of theories. Right now, we're right before Chinese New Year, as Eli mentioned. One of the reasons why is because there's a major petrochemical plant in Pengzhou, which is in proximity to Chengdu, and a lot of pollution that we experience here comes from that plant in particular. And a lot of people are talking about that plant kind of being run in overtime right now to make up for the loss in productivity for Chinese New Year. And I think that's kind of one of the really rational, concrete explanations of the pollution. But there are some other ones which seem a little bit less strong. One thing I noticed is people are burning things kind of everywhere in Chengdu on the street right now. Do you guys notice that?
Yeah. I mean, there are some days where you'll wake up here and it's unavoidable. There's a burning stench, and it's not just attributable to factory pollution or car exhaust or anything like that. I mean, when I was here in 2011, somebody said that people were burning crops. Mm-hmm.
That does happen. And there's sometimes when there's smoke from people who are burning like the husks of the harvest.
There are local governments all around China that blame the pollution on exactly that, on burning crops.
That's a good scapegoat. But I mean, as far like you're talking about a lack of data, I'm not sure how much of the pollution is from factories around, like the one that you just mentioned in Pengzhou, and how much is attributable to the growing amount of automobiles in the city area. Like, how much are we breathing, like, right on the street level?
Yeah.
Certainly a lot. Yeah. I mean, if you're near a major road in Chengdu, you can smell that the pollution is much stronger than if you're not near a major road. And that's definitely due to automobiles.
That's true. And that's probably, you know, a factor in the local proximity area of the pollution that you feel on the street. But the amount that's lingering in the high atmosphere and that's causing the sky to turn gray, I don't think is the result of increased automobile usage or a result of seasonal crop burning or other sort of, residential burning sources. The reason being that, you know, there's a lot of automobile use in the United States as well. And although there is serious air pollution in some major U.S. cities, you don't see it to the degree in the high concentration of PM2.5 that you do in China. And to me, that has to be attributable to industrial sources.
Mm-hmm. So for you guys obviously follow the air pollution levels as I do. What mm-hmm. way do you guys follow that data?
So when I was working in New York for an online publication called ChinaFile, one of my colleagues, he runs a website called China Air Daily. It has no affiliation with the China Daily. But he posts pictures every day. He gathers pictures from different sources.
What's the name of the guy who runs that?
Michael...
Zhao?
Michael Zhao, yes.
He contacted me, actually. So I did something recently about 2 years ago on Chengdu Living, and I called it Chengdu Air.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at chengduliving.com/air. And 2 years ago, I mean, exactly 2 years ago, actually, in January of 2012, or 2013, we were going through this period of incredible pollution, which had kind of never been seen before in Chengdu. And this was during the Beijing airpocalypse time.
Mm.
And so I would go into my roof every morning at a predetermined time and take a photo of the sky and then post the temperature and the pollution levels.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I did this was to try to see what connection there was between the appearance of the sky and the actual pollution levels.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I found was that often the sky would be really dark and it would look really dismal and kind of apocalyptic, but the pollution wouldn't even really be that high. Or the sky would look pretty blue and pretty clean and the pollution would be really high. And so, you know, China Air Daily is just a much more complete, you know, comprehensive version of that. But that's a good place to see what's going on across all of China.
So he reached out to you, and what did he say, Michael Zhao?
He reached out to me and said, I'm already collecting data on air conditions in Beijing and Shanghai.
He's like, get off my turf, fool.
No, well, he wasn't in Chengdu. And so I was already producing, you know, more or less exactly the same kind of content that he was. And, you know, really his site is like an aggregate of information across major Chinese cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just makes sense for him to include Chengdu in that information.
Yeah.
But what ended up happening with the Chengdu Living Air Project was after Chinese New Year in 2013, the condition improved markedly, and I just kind of lost interest in doing this. So mm-hmm. I stopped doing it after about 3 months. But China Air Daily has continued on, so good for him.
Yeah.
It's a lot of time commitment to consistently gather that data, no question.
Yeah, absolutely. So not only do they have pictures every day from the same exact spot in cities all over China, they compare them to comparably large cities in the United States, so you can get a frame of reference.
So you can feel bad about it.
Right. Well, I mean, if you're living in China, so you can feel bad about it. If you're living in the U.S., so you can be thankful for it and not take it for granted. But he also has a graph, a line graph, charting the last...
How soon you're going to die.
Yeah, basically the expiration date on your life. But before we change topics, I just want to say, one time a couple weeks ago, when I was feeling particularly crappy and I attributed it to the pollution, I went on a little bit of a research myself, and I found... we'll link this in the description. I don't remember exactly what website. I think it was Beijing Health. But he, like you said, there's so much conjecture, and a lot of people here say that walking outside when it's when the air quality index is over 300 is the equivalent of smoking X amount of cigarettes.
Yes,
he crunched the numbers.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's, all right.
I posted it on the Chengdu Living forum, and I'm really enthusiastic about that link. I mean,
mm-hmm.
not only because that doctor, who's an American doctor based in Beijing,
right.
He takes a scientific approach to breaking down the health implications of, you know, living here and breathing the air,
mm-hmm.
but also he, you know, delivers the conclusion which I want.
I'm waiting for this answer with bated breath.
It's going to be a little disappointing, actually.
Well, it's equivalent, I think, to smoking like half a cigarette a day.
He said it's actually a sixth of a cigarette.
The sixth of a cigarette a day.
If it's over, yeah, I'm not sure if it's over AQI 300 mm-hmm. or a little bit less than that, but it's around there. And he himself said, well, after hearing people say like it's the equivalent of smoking multiple cigarettes, just to find out that it's a sixth of a cigarette, that was, I mean, it's great that it doesn't have such a large impact,
right.
but maybe we are overstating the impact on our daily lives and on our health.
Well, that's
exactly
true. I mean, there's the concrete health effects, and then there's also the psychological effects. And I think sometimes those can get kind of intermingled together in our perception of the problem.
And it might have been psychosomatic.
When I first came to Chengdu, within 2 months, I had bronchitis.
Yeah.
And I'm a non-smoker. I'd never had bronchitis in my life. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of anecdotal evidence which says that the air pollution really has serious implications.
Yeah. Well, one thing that, you know, this piece of data sort of should remind us of the fact is that, of course, breathing in particulate matter from being in a polluted city is bad for your health, but smoking cigarettes is a really direct and concentrated
right.
way to breathe in particulate matter, and
like,
people do it all the time willingly.
It's like fixing your mouth on the end of a factory and just like sucking it in.
And when, I mean, here I think it's probably any time we talk about this issue, we want to give a plug to smart air filters.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, we'll get to that in a second.
One thing I want to say is when they were doing their research, one of the things that they compared the PM2.5 concentration levels of was when they were inside and outside and in like a cafe where somebody was smoking on the other side of the room. And one of the surprising pieces of data that came out of that was that even in a cafe where there's nobody smoking in your immediate vicinity, but there are people smoking in the room somewhere, you know, kind of on the other side, and you're not even aware that it's a smoky bar, the PM2.5 concentration is through the roof. I mean, it's mm-hmm. way higher than even like a very polluted day outside. So, yeah.
So what's it like in a Chengdu nightclub?
It's like 2,000. You know? or like the New Year's party with all that concrete dust floating around.
Oh, God.
Right. So actually, the reasons for the pollution is actually one interesting thing which I found when I started looking into this. So the city in Dazhou in Sichuan province has been talked about recently because the deputy head of the Dazhou Environmental Protection Bureau made a public statement about the pollution in Sichuan because a lot of people are concerned about this now. And what he said was very interesting. We spoke about scapegoats already. Mm. This is a particularly colorful scapegoat. He blamed it on the city smoking bacon, which is a traditional method of preserving pork, which local residents have done for well over 1,000 years. And I thought this was really interesting because on Weibo, netizens have mocked his statement really to an amazing degree. And they say that, you know, the city would smell like bacon, which it doesn't. And they say that smoking bacon has a long history, but smog does not. So there are a lot of interesting scapegoats here, and I think local governments are trying to figure out how to explain this condition to the local populace and, you know, make a compelling argument for why this is happening and what's going on.
Are there any conspiracy theories about his connection to the anti-pork lobby in China, or is that have they not touched upon that?
I mean,
we should dig a little bit deeper is what I'm trying to say.
Right, actually, so I read some of this. I mean,
maybe he's not just blowing smoke.
So what do you guys do to protect yourself from this? So now that we've established that the pollution is real, it's a legitimate threat, and we've kind of talked about what the reasons are for this, you know, what is the useful information that people can take from this to improve the situation for themselves? The first thing is smart air, I think, which we're all a really big fan of.
Mm.
What do you guys... Tell me about smart air and how you use it, Eli.
Yeah, I mean, first, just going back to the Dazhou thing for a second, I think, you know, we have to give a tip of the hat to the sarcastic reflexes of the internet and thank social media for helping us to circulate the ignorance and stupidity and foolishness that sometimes authorities can float out into the discussion. That's something that the U.S. media is great about, and Chinese social media is starting to get a little bit better about. I mean, social media has given us more opportunities to poke fun at some of the ridiculous propaganda that we've been fed for years. I've been to Dazhou. You know, that's the city closest to where the Chevron natural gas project that I work on is located, and it is a terribly, terribly polluted city. Mm. Even though it's relatively far away from Chengdu, if you look at a city like that, you can understand that industrial pollution has to be a major factor because it's not like there's bustling thoroughfares that are producing it.
So you use, I noticed in your house downstairs, I've got three smart air filters in my house,
mm-hmm.
and I love them. There's actually a post on Chengdu Living about it, and I'll link to that in the comments for this podcast. And there's also a guide to setting up kind of an automatic wireless filtration system in your house. Mm. And I'll link to that as well. But I noticed downstairs you have the more expensive of the two smart air filters. So they have two. They have one for 200 RMB and they have one which I think is 400.
The Canon!
The Canon, exactly. So I noticed you have the Canon. I don't have one of those. Do you think that's worth it? How's that worked out for you? I'm curious.
It makes me feel less paranoid that the city is killing me when I'm sitting in my house. So on a psychological level, it's been beneficial. Although I do have a PM 2.5 counter in my house, one of the ones that you helped discover and promote on the forums, I can't say that I use it particularly often.
This is the Samo Air Bare Bones one?
The Samo, yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure. I haven't been as thorough about collecting data on the air quality inside my house as I might ought to be, but it does, on an anecdotal level, it does feel a little bit cleaner. I essentially keep it running 24 hours a day and turn it on high when I leave. So when I come home, the air is a little bit cleaner, but,
what about you, Dan? Are you on the smart air train?
No, I mean, I'm still sort of settling into my apartment and, I don't even have enough coat hangers for my jacket. So I'm working up to air filters, but slowly. Kitchenware comes first. I still need a blanket for my bed. It's on the horizon.
I mean, after I stop sleeping on this pile of rags, the next order of business is to get a bucket that I can shower.
Yeah, do you guys know where I can buy soap? Don't have any soap in my house. Or toilet paper.
All right, that's a no. So one thing that I find interesting is this new Xiaomi product. Have you guys seen this?
Yeah, I have seen it, and I think maybe Xiaomi as a brand and its ascension into this particular niche of the market is something that we can discuss at another time because that's something it seems like everybody's a little bit interested in tracking their story. But
I'm gonna just describe this product real quick. So for anybody who doesn't know, Xiaomi is often called the Apple of China. So they make a wide range of products, and they kind of are in the Apple style in a way that you'll obviously see if you go to their website.
Aesthetically, it is.
Functionally as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the address of their website is mi.com, and the new product is an air filter, which is called the Xiaomi Air. And it's a small, little rectangular stand-up air filter, and it looks really cool. It costs about 900 kuai. Unfortunately, it's not available in Sichuan yet. It's available in 8 cities in China. I don't know why. Like, Chengdu's not one of them.
Xiaomi, their products, they tend to limit their
production,
their production, and where they sell them from. I heard that they're not widely available.
Distributed, yeah.
Well, they're only available in one place, and that's on mi.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should say that would be mi as in mi, not me.
Correct, right? mi.com. And there are actually third-party vendors who are resellers of this and every other Xiaomi product on Taobao, but they come at a little bit of a markup. They're about 1,200 kuai. But that's an interesting thing. I'll link to that as well in the comments for this. And it looks like a really promising kind of product.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think is so novel about having this new Xiaomi air filter? What do you think it kind of represents in the evolution of handling it?
The first thing is that it's really cheap, so it's 900 kuai. That's like, if you get a look at the product, you'll see that is actually a very low price.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about it is that it's really an intelligent air filter. And what I mean by that is you have an app which you can use to control and configure the filter. So you can set timers on it. You can make it turn on automatically at a certain time. And it kind of like, has the same kind of functionality as what I did with the smart air filter and the wireless plug. Exactly. So it's kind of similar to that, but it's a lot easier. It certainly looks a lot better. I mean, one of the criticisms of the smart air filter is that it looks like a filter just Velcroed onto a fan, which it is, quite literally.
Because it is.
Yeah, which it is. So, aesthetically, it certainly looks
a lot
better.
It is the newest
appealing.
Velcro technology, though. Can I ask, is the Xiaomi app that controls the Xiaomi air filter only available on Xiaomi phones?
No, it's available on iPhone.
Okay. Ooh, okay. Do they, whatever. I don't have any questions. No questions regarding that. I'm excited to use my new Xiaomi, though. I'm hopping on the Xiaomi train.
We should, another time we'll talk in greater detail about Xiaomi. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going on with Xiaomi right now, and that is a major topic of discussion. I frequently see articles in Wall Street Journal and Forbes talking about Xiaomi.
And actually, when I was back in the States, there was coverage on Marketplace, the American Public Media NPR business news show, where they were like, it was like, get used to Xiaomi, and like bringing them telling.
It was because CES just happened and Xiaomi had a lot of
a coming out party.
Yeah, it was the Consumer Electronic
show.
Show.
Yeah.
And, okay, so before we move on to our next topic, just have a word from our sponsor, the Chengdu Living Podcast today, brought to you by Xiaomi. The, many people have called them the Apple of China. As seen in Forbes and Marketplace. Okay, I guess.
So let's jump over to the next topic, which is the Uber ban in China.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an interesting one. I actually took Uber in China for my first time recently, and it was with you, Eli. So let's, for anybody who doesn't know about Uber, I don't think there are many people who listen to this that don't know about Uber, but let me describe it really quickly. Uber is an app-based transportation and taxi company.
No, this is where you start your Uber introduction. Thank you for your birthday card, Grandma. Uber, if you need...
We get it. They should know what Uber is.
I'll help you set up your iTunes when I come to visit this summer.
No offense to any of the grandmas listening out there.
I'm sorry. Yeah. That was pretentious of me.
Yeah.
Everybody knows about Uber then. Okay, I'll just skip that.
No. I think a brief summary is probably in order. It's a rideshare app.
It's an app where you use your smartphone to call a car to pick you up, be it a taxi or an ordinary car with a driver.
All right, and it's convenient here. Why?
It's convenient anywhere, really, because you don't have to own a car. You don't have to worry about parking. You're paying a lower rate for that service than you would be through the traditional commercial channels.
Mm.
And that is, I think, sort of the crux of some of the problems that Uber has run into.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the problems that Uber has run into is why this is a really interesting topic. So Uber launched in China in July of 2014 in Beijing. And since then, it's kind of been gaining in popularity and it's been expanding to more and more cities. Currently, it's in 8 cities around China, and Chengdu is one of them. And they've been promoting it really heavily in Chengdu over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, they've worked with a lot of local events. I know one of the local bars.
Which one?
Jellyfish.
Yeah, they worked.
They were sponsored by Uber, I think.
They contacted me about cooperating with Dojo, so we worked with them briefly. They worked with Sinostage as well, right?
Yeah, we had a co-promotion with them. They did a co-promotion with Beer Nest. They did a co-promotion with Raffle City. I mean, they're basically working together with any local small, middle-sized corporations who are willing to help promote them and get them in touch because they want to build, they want to cultivate those consumer habits and get people in the routine of just picking up their phone and clicking the app when they want to get a car rather than thinking about a taxi.
Mm-hmm.
But they're willing to pay a premium to try to build those habits in people by giving it to them at below market price.
Mm-hmm.
They're facing major problems in China right now, though. So as of, I think, about 2 weeks ago, they are officially banned in China, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And there are major penalties for people who are driving Uber cars and for people who are taking Uber as a passenger. And this is not kind of a problem that's unique to China. Uber faces issues, regulatory opposition in particular, in dozens of different countries. And most of these are first world countries like Australia, Belgium, Canada, even the United States and California as well. And the crux of the issue is that Uber uses unlicensed drivers who do not have taxi licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the nature of China's issue as well, the regulatory concerns surrounding that.
I think that's a problem with all kind of shared economy industry apps, which is to say that they can provide you something at a lower price point because they're not going through the same regulatory channels that those traditional providers would be going to, and that that allows them to give it to you cheaper, but that also means that maybe they're not being as closely scrutinized, and if you're somebody operating in the traditional industry, you might feel like they're unfairly getting access to these customers without being subject to the same scrutiny. So you can see it, obviously, with Uber, with pushback from the taxi unions in a lot of European cities and some U.S. cities as well. You can also see it if you look at something like Airbnb and the opposition from the hotel industry.
Yeah.
There's another similar shared economy thing that's for sharing meals, where you go to people's house, and the same thing, you get pushback from the restaurant industry, where they say, oh, you know, you can't just have people going to the house of an individual and eating dinner and then paying
because they're not subject to like health inspection.
They're not subject to health inspection. So from a consumer perspective, you know, maybe we feel like some of that regulation is a little bit unnecessary and it's holding back the market forces where we would be able to get a better product at a cheaper price if it wasn't subject to that government regulation. And that may be partially true, and we also may be running a risk by getting it through these sort of back alley channels that have now been formalized through the networks of technology that are available to us.
But let's bring it back to China. In a country like this where they're notoriously bad at enforcing laws, mm-hmm. What is the actual likelihood?
Regulatory benefit
that
we're not getting.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah, why is this happening? The reason why this is happening is because the established taxi companies are lobbying for Uber to get banned, and they've been successful.
Yeah.
So Uber has been growing and expanding for 5 months in 2014. And then as of January 1st, 2015, now it is officially banned. And it was in a statement to the Financial Times that the director of Beijing's traffic enforcement unit, Liang Jiangwei, said the use of unlicensed taxis by internet hailing apps violates a ban on illegal taxis.
So does that's not just Uber that's banned. That's any taxi hailing app. What other taxi hailing apps are there?
Incorrect. The problem is not hailing taxis. Hailing taxis is fine.
If hailing unlicensed cars,
exactly. That's
so,
the issue.
So are there are apps out there that do call license?
They all do.
Yeah, there are multiple apps which are competing with each other to hail legitimate taxis. And those are doing just fine. And those are the ones that are really in a majority, dominant position. Those are the incumbents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, so I think you wrote an article about Didi Quatcha on Chengdu.
I did. I wrote an article about Didi Quatcha.
We'll put that in the comments.
Yeah, I'll put that in the comments. Didi Quatcha is just an amazing tool. And so that is probably overjoyed by this news.
Uh-huh.
But mm-hmm. the extent of the crackdown on Uber is pretty intense. So it begun on January 1st, and the deputy director who I just mentioned said that drivers can face fines up to $3,000. And the crackdown has been set in motion due to lobbying efforts from China's biggest and most established licensed taxi companies.
Well, I can tell you, I have taken an Uber since January 1st.
We took an Uber together.
After that, yeah.
Okay, so it is not in effect on January 1st for real. It's going to take a while for them to actually crack down.
Let's see. They've begun the crackdown, but there are still people presumably operating in spite of this.
Yeah. One interesting thing to note about Uber was, you're already looking at a situation where these people are entering the market at a price point that's lower than traditional taxis. But one really interesting thing is because they were so eager to get the attention of customers here in China, they were lowering it even below their cost. They were lowering their selling rates even below their cost. So I've been riding around in Ubers quite a bit recently and done a little bit of talking to some of the drivers. And one of the things that you learn from them is that they're getting paid more from Uber than we are actually paying them. So when we're being charged something like 100 kwai, they're getting paid 150 or 200 kwai from Uber.
So it's being subsidized by
Uber. It's being subsidized by Uber, even though it was already lower than what you would probably be paying for with a taxi. So I'm kind of sad to see it go because it's a darn convenient tool. I do understand the grievances that the taxi lobbyists might have, and I hope that we'll end up meeting somewhere in the middle.
Here's the thing, though. I mean, when Uber started to make a big push in China last summer, I thought in my head, there's really no need for Uber to be here. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the United mm-hmm. States, there's absolutely a clear use of Uber, and that is you live in a major city, you want to drive. You know, want to ride somewhere, you don't want a car. You know what I mean? Or you go to a club, you go to a bar, you want to drink somewhere, you don't want to park, and you don't want to worry about the hassle of that. Right. That's totally legitimate. The situation is different in China, in major cities, because taxis are everywhere. You can get a taxi anywhere at any time, and you already have these apps like Didi Quatcha, which can allow you to hail a taxi, should you be in some kind of special circumstance where you can't find one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the conditions are quite different. And I also thought at that time, it would be very easy for Didi Quatcha to just incorporate a feature where they can have a private car, like a Buick or a town car or whatever, pick you up.
Uh-huh.
And now they have that feature.
Yes, they do.
So really, what is the functional advantage of using Uber? Like, I just have a hard time picturing what it is. The only, small contingent of users that Uber really has a head up on are expats who don't speak Chinese.
Right. That's what I was just going to say. People who are familiar with the brand and don't want to experiment with some Chinese app that they're going to have to use their non-existent Chinese for, it's going to be a little bit more difficult for them to swallow that.
Also, I think having the payment integrated into your smartphone or some sort of electronic payment function is a slight advantage over some of those taxi hailing apps where you actually, at the end of the day, when you get out of the car, you still have to exchange money. And one of the really convenient, catering to the lazy impulse in all of us features of Uber is that when you get to your destination, you just get out of the car and you just touch a button on your smartphone and it's done. That's not a big deal, but, you know, what are the benefits of Uber versus that? That's something that they can tout.
In what circumstances have you used Uber in the past, Eli? Because I've been a passenger in Uber just with other people. I've never actually hailed an Uber car.
Well, you know, sometimes we have visitors from the United States who are here, and we want to drive them around in a nice car. Mm. Also, if you're planning to go to someplace that's outside of the Zhaocheng, the perimeter of the city where the taxis won't go, then having an Uber is really, really handy because they'll go out there for you. And because of the way that their pay structure is worked out with their either the taxi companies that pays the drivers that Uber then pays, the way that their payment agreement is worked out, they don't mind waiting for you. So you can go, and we've done this on several occasions with visitors, taking Uber out to the Panda place and have the Uber driver just wait for them there while they go inside. And the drivers won't complain about it because it's not coming out of their bottom line because they're paid per day. And that's something that's not always easy to settle with your drivers if you're just arranging for a car privately.
They won't wait, yeah.
They won't wait, or they'll charge you to wait because they really don't want to do that. So that's one of the really convenient things. Same thing with going outside of the perimeter. If you have a taxi company, a lot of times they're limited to inside the perimeter, and they'll bargain with you in a real, you know, a sort of painfully fierce way if you want to go outside of the city. One of the biggest benefits of Uber, I think, is that you eliminate the need to have to hash out a price with the driver where you're not really sure what the fair market price is, and you're not sure if they're cheating you or they're getting an unfair deal, and Uber is kind of setting it according to some sort of algorithm that's based on the market rate that's, you know, presumably more fair for both of you. I do think that's something that they bring to the table that's beneficial.
One last question about Uber. A lot of people who complain about it in the States, at least, talk about, like, when there's a high demand for Uber, there's surge pricing. Does that happen at all here, or is there not?
I don't think there's a high demand for Uber.
Yeah, exactly. So, what are the main complaints about it doesn't exist here?
I'll tell you the reason why, because I've only taken two rides on Uber, and both times it was the same car and the same driver.
Well, that is very anecdotal, and that could just be very, very fortunate, maybe. But, yeah, that could also point to just there just being one Uber.
I think they're having a little bit of trouble getting off the ground. But,
for
you know,
sure, yeah.
But
I mean, the competition is extremely intense. The number of expats who have loyalty to the Uber brand are probably very few in Chengdu.
Mm. Yeah. And I'm sure that their goal is to break into the Chinese market. And
anybody who wants to.
And that's not easy. Yeah, that's not easy to do. It's hard to change Chinese consumer behavior, as a lot of people have found out. Mm-hmm. To me, actually, it seems a little bit similar to my previous experience with alcohol brands like Captain Morgan when I was working for them, and they were trying to get people to drink Captain Morgan's rum. One of the things that they had to combat is people's unfamiliarity with that liquor. I mean, Chinese people just don't drink rum. It's not part of their palate. And Chinese people are just not used to using apps to pay for their cars. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you can say, you know, why would they need to get used to it the same way? Why would you need to start drinking rum? They could drink Baijiu just as easily, and mm-hmm. you kind of have to convince them that it's better.
This segment has been brought to you by Uber and Captain Morgan Rum. Always a good time. Captain Morgan Rum.
When you're drunk on Captains, call an Uber.
Okay. Should we move on?
Let's jump into the third topic, which is life in China real? And so Dan asked this question and kind of set this up, so why don't you explain the context for this question?
Sure. So before I asked this question on Reddit and sort of crowdsourced people's opinions, I was inspired by my conversations with foreigners here. I never asked them this question. It always came up kind of as a throwaway comment or an aside. People would phrase it differently. Some people would just flat out say, life in China, you know, isn't real. And I imagine their baseline for real life is whatever they grew up with because,
you should read the entire question that you asked.
Sure. I'm going to do that in 1 second. I was also inspired by some people who were leaving the country and saying they were going back to their home country, and they were saying going back to reality, and that struck me as very strange because I feel like life in China is just as real, if not sometimes more real. But it was always a really vague topic, and mm-hmm. the concept of what is real, I had a hard time kind of grasping what people were trying to say. So I crowdsourced it, and I phrased the question like this. Do you think life in China is any less real than your life back home? Take this question however you like. I just wanted to ask this question because I heard it from people who are at different points in their China life. It didn't seem to just be one type of person saying this. So I was compelled to ask the question, and I got a lot of great responses, and it really made me think a lot about it. I conceived this question as limited to China originally, and some of the things that people responded with on Reddit made me think that it's not so much a facet of China life, but of expat life in general. Before I go into what people on Reddit said, I want to hear what you guys thought when this question was posed to you.
So I actually didn't leave I saw the thread before I even knew that you created it, by the way. So I saw the discussion around it, and I thought it was interesting. I agree with you. I think that China life in China is completely real, but I can see how it's not real for some people, or I can see how some people think it's not real.
I can see what it is that they're trying to point to when they say that it's not
real. And maybe just not saying it as eloquently as they possibly could. They're maybe not able to put their finger on it, but you know what they're pointing towards.
That's right.
Well, I mean, certainly people who are outside of China and have never been to China or never been to Asia or never been outside their home country certainly don't understand, I think, you know, what life is like here. And as a result of that, they feel like, what are you doing messing around in Asia? Why don't you come back to the real world, which is over here, and do the things that everybody else does? Because that's what people do, and that's what reality is.
Mm-hmm.
There was a comment that sort of pointed that out. They said that the commenter on Reddit said something along the lines of, you're sort of outside of the normal process that people... that you've grown up with and went to college with are taking back home in their home country, wherever that is. And to people back home, it seems sort of like a vacation or something that sooner or later you're going to get back on the treadmill with everybody else. But right now, it's not.
There's a little bit of a feeling that the distinction of life in China being not real is somehow kind of condescending or dismissive. When I kind of interpret it to be the opposite of that a little bit. I mean, if life is not real in China, I take it to be bizarre and kind of fantastical, and it kind of is those two things, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I do think that maybe the thing that I don't like about that particular description about what makes expat life in China unique as being not real is that it sounds like it's vaguely pejorative.
Yeah,
As though it's kind of... if we're living here, we're out of touch with reality or irresponsible or, you know, taking a break from the actual world that we're going to eventually get back to. And maybe that's not giving credit to all the interesting adventures and hardworking projects that people living as expats abroad are getting into. However, that being said, at the same time, I think we can all identify people that we've met whose expat experience is very much an escape, a prolonged escape from the responsibilities or, you know, emotional baggage that they may be carrying back home.
Certainly. And I feel like this stereotype is targeted directly at those people.
Mm. And that's related to one of the comments that I really liked in response to this question.
Why don't you read the comment?
Sure. Somebody said, a lot of expat communities are rather transient. Not much language, no real local friends, a job that kind of feels like a resort-style job. A temp job with a temp life. And I think a lot of people who responded did point to the transience, that nobody here is trying to carve out... the people who talk like this are not carving out permanent lives for themselves. And so they do kind of conceive of it as temporary job, temporary life. And that affects the way that people act here. Not just here, but apparently in expat communities in general.
Maybe we can talk about what are the sort of good things or accurate things that they are pointing out with this observation. Because I do think that there are some aspects of life here that are a little bit not unreal, but
life in China is not a vacation, really. I mean, no one. I don't think it's a good place to come to just be laid back and just kind of like go with the flow. China's really not that kind of country.
There's Thailand for that, and it's the weather's a lot nicer.
Well, I do think that English in some ways we experience a subsidy living here as foreigners, and that it's easier.
What kind of subsidy?
It's easier to jump into the middle class without having a certain set of qualifications that might be necessary to enter into the middle class in your home country. To me, that subsidy comes in the form of having a fallback industry that can land you in the middle class without having any particular qualifications, which is being an English teacher. Mm-hmm. And maybe this subsidy is not quite as present now as it was 5 or 10 years ago, but it was certainly true when I got here, and I think it is true in some quarters, that you can step off the plane without having any particular qualifications, without being particularly educated or articulate or having any experience in the education industry, and get yourself a full-time job that will afford you a nice apartment and more than enough money to live a middle-class life here. And in some ways that is a little bit, might create an unrealistic set of expectations for people living here compared to the degree of competition that they would have to face in the workforce in their home countries to be able to survive as an upper middle class resident of a city.
I think that's really well put. It's impossible to avoid the fact that we are treated, we are held to a different standard and we're given different opportunities than people who have grown up and lived here. And it's based on a very superficial fact that we're, it's not based on our skills, it's based on the fact of where we come from.
Is that really a bad thing, or is it really fair to be criticized for that? I mean, let's say someone who's uneducated and unskilled in the United States doesn't have a job, right? So it's kind of recession, post-recession kind of conditions there, difficult to find work. Instead of being a server at Applebee's, maybe you come to China and you teach English and you save $1,000 a month.
Absolutely. And there's nothing, I think you're right, there's nothing that has to be negative about that or unrealistic. Maybe that's a very responsible and strategic thing for somebody to do, to go find a market where you can get paid better for what you can bring to the table. And so that's why calling it unreal might not be the right way to describe it. But there is something where we are experiencing a strategic benefit in the marketplace that is not related to our innate abilities. Mm-hmm. It's related to our nationality.
I think there's almost a certain skill required to even make a leap to come to China. You know, only a small minority of people will even be able to make that jump. Mm-hmm. And those people who do make that jump are kind of rewarded with these opportunities that a lot of people can't have, a vast majority of people can't have.
Right, but I don't think the willingness to make that jump to another country is a big enough skill that actually should justify your ability to get paid more than a local person in that economy, because that certainly is not true the other way around.
Well, the market says otherwise.
Right. Well, it doesn't say otherwise when it's somebody going to the United States from another country. You can have that desire.
That's the United States market. The China market says if you are a foreigner from America or from a Western country and you come here, you have a job.
Right.
Because there's a demand.
I know, but I'm just saying that impulse, the willingness to go abroad, is not universally a skill.
Clearly.
That's gonna.
It's about China. It's not just about crossing borders.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how this impacts the way people act here. Because some people come here and, at least according to the responses that I received about 90 responses to this, and a lot of people talked about the way this unreal life that they couldn't really put their finger on changed the way they act. The top voted comment said this: for me, it's not real in the way I feel like many of the things I do don't have consequences. So I can be rude, burn bridges, do embarrassing stuff, and when the day's over, I don't have to do damage control because people see everything I do and chalk it up to just being a foreigner. In the quote-unquote real world, you'd have to take responsibility for your actions, but here, you can just kind of say, "Ting budong, I don't understand," and you're off the hook.
Well, I do think there's he's hitting on something, which is aside from having preferential treatment by the economy to some degree, there's also a little bit of expanded social tolerance.
I think is putting it very lightly.
Mildly,
I remember when I first
the
came here.
Of
when I first came to Chengdu, people would stop me in the street and just want to shake my hand,
and I would spit in their face, and they.
I thought it was really weird. I mean, I was really suspicious of them. I thought they wanted to take advantage of me in some way, and I felt very insecure about strangers just wanting to shake my hand. And it took some time for me to realize that mm-hmm. these people are legitimately just want to interact with people who are from a different place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean that's. Another thing that I've been thinking about quite a lot, and I think that contributes to people's sense that it's not real life here, because from your home country, at least speaking for myself, I didn't feel too different being a white male in America. You're not often put in you're not often in a situation where you feel like an outsider, whereas here you are stared at and you get looked at. So yeah. So this doesn't necessarily make people act like spectacles, but it makes them feel like a spectacle. And the way people respond to that is going to be different from person to person. But I think it undeniably has an effect on the way you think, and may have an effect on the way you act. And it definitely affects the way you consider yourself in the context of this community.
Yes. Here's an interesting effect which I've noticed. So I've been in Chengdu for a long time, as you have, Eli. And what I've noticed is, obviously, if a foreigner's around, you know, if you walk around the street, you probably get stared at by people. I mean, I do usually because I'm very tall, but also just because I'm a foreigner, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I notice is that after being here a long time, when I see a foreigner in the street, I stare at them, and I think that they look weird just because they look different from everyone else. Mm-hmm. And that's just a result of China being such an ethnically homogenous place. I mean, it's 98% Han Chinese people. And so anything that deviates from that ethnically just stands out a lot.
Yeah, that's true. And it definitely affects people's behavior and can probably exacerbate some of the negative personality traits that some of the expats have when they already come over here, where you get kind of pampered and forgiven and enabled in some of your immature behavior. And that can have bad consequences for people's development and maybe lead them to have that perception that this is a world where consequences don't exist. But I do think that there's limitations to that, and maybe some that swath of tolerance is diminishing a little bit as foreigners become a more commonplace sight in China, and Chinese people become less wowed and you know, have the starstruck attitude when they see a foreigner.
It is. Another popular thread actually on the China subreddit on Reddit is asking the question, do you feel less comfortable in China than you did a year ago? And the vast majority of people said yes, they do feel less comfortable now.
That's probably a good thing. I think in some ways we got better treatment than we deserved for a long period of time, and it was probably not good for the Chinese perception of foreigners.
I disagree. I think it's a bad thing. I think it's because China is closing to the outside world.
Is that so? I mean,
yes. Foreign companies in China are getting raided at dawn. Foreigners feel less welcome. The news and media, in particular, this is really like arms of the government, which make people feel less welcome in China, not Chinese people, I think.
Mm. That kind of cracking down is something I don't think is a positive trend. But the romanticization of foreigners is something I don't think is particularly healthy. So if people are trying, if that misconception is being disabused and is disappearing a little bit, I do think that's good. If we're being demystified, I don't like that exotification that happens either way, where people exotify Chinese people in the West or when people in China exotify people in America. So, but I hear what you're saying as well. There is some actual sort of nationalistic trends or xenophobic trends that may be emerging as well, and those are probably
they took English out of the Gaokao. I mean, this is like a
no.
Very,
that's good.
This is a very clear like turning point.
No, that's good.
Away from the West.
That's good. I think having the English in the Gaokao as a mandatory thing was out of sync with the realities of the market, and I think that was one of the things that most directly contributed to the economic subsidization of foreigners' lives here. Because when we say you can step off the plane with a criminal record and no background in education and jump into middle class, that was because you could always find a job teaching English. And the reason that you could always find a job teaching English was because there was a demand, because every single kid who wanted to go to college and wanted to have a good future had to do well on the Gaokao, and the Gaokao required them to speak English. So it was an oversized demand for English teaching professionals that was out of sync with the actual market demand for people speaking English, because 100% of kids are going to study English to take their Gaokao, but maybe 10%, maybe 5% of those kids are actually going to end up using English in their future job, which means 95% of those kids are studying English and probably paying tuition to some sort of English language training school to acquire some skill that they're never going to end up using in the real world.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. So to wrap this up, what do you guys suggest to make China more real? Is there anything that people can do which makes China more real, or what kind of lifestyle changes are there which make it more real?
I think the most important thing is integration. I think if you only spend time with expats here, it is going to feel very transient. Not because you might be leaving soon, but because the expat population is very fluid. Mm-hmm. And your relationships, if they have a perceived deadline or expiration date, rather, it's not going to feel, your life here won't feel stable.
I agree. I think it's that the rootlessness of that community contributes to that feeling of unreality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's, integration is the interesting word to use to describe it. I think it's always, I mean, it's, the whole time I've been in China, I've always been kind of fascinated by all these different things which I don't understand. And so when I go back to the United States, my home country, I feel like that part of my brain kind of shuts down because I have a basic understanding of how everything works. In China, it's very much the opposite. Even after a decade in China, there are still so many things which I don't understand. So I feel like I'm constantly being pushed to understand more of these cultural and historic things. A lot of language is a big part of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so to do that, you surround yourself with Chinese people and you really, you know, hit the books, so to speak, and you try to educate yourself and expand your knowledge.
Well, it doesn't feel unreal if you're invested and have connections with the local world.
True.
And so I think in terms of dissipating that feeling of disconnect, you know, has to do with making those connections and building a life for yourself here. And then it feels silly to call it unreal when you have those connections.
Yeah, I mean, going to college and seeing a bunch of foreign students flocking together, whatever country they're from, kind of just like an enclave of Korean students or Chinese students or students from another country. I would always look at them and I'd be like, why aren't they making the effort to try to assimilate, and why aren't they hanging out?
You're presuming that the whole reason, you know, if you come to China, you came to China for China, right? Not for an expat circle.
Right, exactly. And so now I find myself criticizing myself and other foreigners for the same offense. Why are you here only spending time with people that make you comfortable? Why aren't you going out and really trying to understand the place that you're living in and living in a bit of a bubble?
We need to get a Chinese person on this podcast.
Yeah, I was about to say. I think we can all agree as foreigners sitting here that just talking amongst yourselves and acting in an insular way is not good to that. But
absolutely. And so, I mean, that's something I've resolved to do. And, I mean, you guys have been here a long time and you have your own various circles. I think having multiple social circles is something that's pretty common here. Expat circles and Chinese circles, or multiple Chinese circles and multiple expat circles. But it is a unique community that, being abroad and being outside of your familiar culture, it pushes you, and some people resist that push and try their best to stay in a comfortable situation or something that's as familiar as could possibly be.
Yeah, and I do think that that's something that is not unique to the expat community in China. It's something that probably exists to varying degrees.
Absolutely.
In expat countries all over, expat communities all over the world.
Closing thoughts. What do you got a closing line? What's your final?
The spot there.
We're about an hour. Yeah, we got.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. That's good.
I'll go first. So, first thing which we didn't mention during the pollution segment was pollution masks. So I use a Respro mask, which I strongly recommend. You can get it from the Natuki Bicycle Shop in Chengdu if you're there. Otherwise, you can get it on Taobao. And Happy New Year. That's the last one.
Yeah, Happy New Year. I still have people saying Happy New Year to me, and I guess it's going to happen through Chengdu, right?
This is Chinese Happy New Year time almost. So
that's
the Happy New Year that I had in mind. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, Happy New Year from today and onward.
Thanks for listening. I'm Eli.
All right. I'm Charlie.
This is Dan.